You know, when we look at our former association, and we look back at what in fact has gone on in the past, but if we look at them now, and we look at the change in the Feast of Tabernacles, we can actually, as far as I understand it anyway, they actually now give a selection of dates which you choose from for the autumn conference. And that's the way in which they structure what used to be the feast. They actually allow everybody to choose the date that they want to, and they have a selection that they can therefore choose from. But that apostasy actually started much, much earlier. And I just wonder whether we realize this. You know, looking at it now, looking at the way in which that date is being chosen, is when you go back in time and have a look at the feast, you can see certain other things actually taking place. And I do wonder, in fact, whether in fact we've managed to get back on track. Now, turn with me, if you would, to Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 8. Nehemiah chapter 8. We find here Nehemiah. Now, this was not the Feast of Tabernacles yet, at this particular part. It was actually the Feast of Trumpets, that the people gathered themselves together as one man in the street that was before the water gate. And they actually started preaching out of the law. They started teaching people what, in fact, the law had to say. It's interesting that when you come down in verse 11, it says, "So the Levites stilled all the people, saying, hold your peace, for the day is holy, neither be grieved," because they were upset at what they were hearing from the law. And it says, "All the people went," in verse 12, "all the people went their way to eat and to drink and to send portions and to make great mirth, because they had understood the words that were declared unto them." And it was the word of God that actually caused them to keep that feast. And as it goes on to explain within this passage, they actually went on to keep the Feast of Tabernacles as well. But it was the word of God that gave them the great delight and to make great mirth, because they'd understood the words that were declared for them. In other words, that they should in fact rejoice. And at that time, it was the case that they were rebuilding the temple. They were getting back on track. They'd been in Babylon. They'd been captives in Babylon. And they were getting back on track, and they'd rediscovered the law. And when you look at what in fact took place in the church, and you look at the Feast of Tabernacles, and you think, well, where in fact did it start going wrong? Well, you start seeing certain other things that were taking place. As far as I understand, it was only after the apostasy actually began, or after Mr. Tkach actually took over, that they started having cruise ships for the feast. And you ask the question, when you start looking into the feast and what the feast actually stands for, is that the right kind of place for a temporary dwelling? There's a cruise ship going here, there, and everywhere. The idea of catering being done and catered meals. There's nothing wrong with having a catered meal. But that was the attention started shifting in that direction. The accommodation that started to be used was more luxurious. And the outside restaurants that were being, you know, the entire focus of the organization was starting to slide over to being a holiday. It was starting to become a holiday, and then losing track of what in fact the feast was all about. What in fact the feast was all really, why we actually went to the feast. The amusements. I remember one particular feast that we went to. Judy actually went, I think you pulled the plug on this amusement arcade, and that didn't go down very well. But, you know, I think it was the Sabbath, was it? And it was Sabbath day, and they were actually playing on the gaming machines. And she went and pulled the plug and got criticized for it. But it was the case that the attention was being, it was shifting. It was shifting from what the focus of the feast was about onto all these peripheral issues, these physical issues. And in fact, what was happening, it was moving from the way of give and a God-centered approach in life, moving to a way of get, moving to a self-centered approach in life. And that approach was actually happening long, long before you come to the point where they actually start changing the dates, saying, oh, you don't need to keep the law, you don't need to keep the feast. And Yet when you contrast that, you contrast what was going on at that particular time with the Butlins of yore, or those of you that actually went and attended Butlins, it was actually, I think they got their plans from the prison camps in Germany, but it was almost sort of like that. But it was ideal for the church to move into a camp where there were temporary dwellings, small temporary dwellings that people could then use. It was very similar to Big Sandy. It was a Booth City, they used to call it. Booth City, and I think there was Tent City as well. There was, one was booths and one was tents, and people used to go ahead and pitch the tents. And from what I understand from people that have actually been there, it was the camaraderie and the sense of community was ideal, was excellent. And it was that that was, in fact, made the joy, which we see here. Eat and drink, 10 portions, and to make great mirth. Now, mirth is probably a wrong word to use in today's parlance. But, in fact, to rejoice. But it was the community, and the fact that they were learning the law at that particular time. So when we see what, in fact, took place, I wonder whether we in the Church of God in Wales, have actually come out of that frame of mind. We might have think, we therefore keep the feast, we keep the right days, we go to the feast at the right time. And we see worldwide going down a route that is antinomian, against the law. And we think, well, we're fine. But are we really? Or have we brought on board, have we actually got our ideas, our concepts regarding the Feast of Tabernacles, are we back on track? Are we really back on track regarding that in our attitudes of mind, in our frame of mind, as far as the feast is concerned? So I want to give a sermon today about plan for God's feast. Now, it's a play on words in some ways, because it's plan for God's feast this year. Yes, definitely. We need to plan, and we need to have started planning at the end of last year's feast, quite frankly, saving second tithe and so on, and certainly plan for feast this year. But also for 2014, if we're still around at that particular time, 2014, we need feast sites. Now, I can't be everywhere at once, and I would like people that, if you know of a feast site, that you know of somewhere that you feel suitable that would be a feast site, that you let me know. And I don't mean just say, oh, this place is wonderful, go and look into it. Well, I'd like you to do a little bit of legwork yourself and just find out the prices, find out the size of the camp itself, and contrast that with what we've got at the moment. But I'd like people to do that legwork to some degree. But that is also a planning for the feast, for God's feast, and it is God's. The emphasis is on God's feast. And at the same time as well, it's the plan of God for God's feast, because the God's feast is part of his plan. So very much plan for God's feast is very much part of getting back on track, because that plan is a picture of the millennium, but more than just a picture of the millennium, it's the picture of our part within it as well. And I think it's appropriate for us to look at the subject today, where we've got 3 months before the feast. This time, 3 months, and we'll be at the feast. Just over 3 months, and we'll be at the feast. But what I'd like to look into is the fact that it is a commanded assembly. Because when we're looking at the plan of God's feast, it's a commanded assembly, first and foremost. Secondly, it's the fact that God has got to place his name there. God places his name there. It's God's camp. It's not ours. It's God's camp, and it's got to be kept that way. Thirdly, they are temporary dwellings. They're not the great, luxurious, most wonderful dwellings that we can possibly find. That's not the purpose of God's feast. They're actually designed to be temporary dwellings. There's a specific reason for that. And fourthly, is the fact that it's part of the going to the feast is very much part of being students. We are students of God's system, God's way. We're part of the discipleship that will be, all the disciples of yesteryear will be part of them, teaching God's way in the millennium. And finally, it is a case of picturing that millennial teaching. And it's that millennial teaching. It's not just the millennium. It's not having this wonderful place that the people will come up into, this paradise, this utopia that people will arise into in the last great day. That's not the millennium. The millennium is all the work involved to get to that point, to get to that place. And the picture of the feast is not just the last great day, which is the final day that is there. It is all the work that is involved and the lead up to that. And so when we look at it, and it's also our place as teachers within that time. So that's the final point I want to deal with. And really that final point has much to say to us regarding the entire sermon. Because when we're looking at the entire sermon, we're looking at the fact that it's a picture of the millennium. It's a picture of our part within the millennium as well. Now let's turn over to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23 as a kind of introductory point of reference. And we find in verse 1, the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, say to them, concerning the feasts of the Eternal, which you proclaim to be holy convocations." These are my feasts. So these are holy gatherings. Convocation means a gathering of people. So we need to actually go to the feast. So if we can, we should do everything within our power to get there. Now, I know that some listening to my words right now can't do that, and I appreciate that. You know, it's impossible for certain people to get there, but they are holy convocations. We should try and log in. We should try and log in live if we can, if we are unable to get there specifically. And it says, then talks about the Sabbath, the convocation, and in verse 4, "These are the feasts of the Eternal, even holy convocations, which you proclaim in their seasons." So the Feast of Tabernacles is part of the convocations, the gatherings that were proclaimed in their seasons. If we go over to verse 34, it says, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of the 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles." Not chosen whenever you like, not a case of you choose whenever you're going to go away and have your holiday in the autumn time. But it was on a specific day that God specified. It was a commanded assembly, God's way, on God's days. And on the first day shall be a holy convocation. That's the first gathering, no servile work, 7 days. And then on the 8th day shall be a holy convocation. So you've got the 8th day, the last great day as well. And as it says in verse 39, "In the 15th day of the 7th month, when you've gathered in the fruit of your land." So it linked up to the harvest periods. And it's very much part of the harvest period because of what it's picturing. "You will keep a feast to the Eternal 7 days. On the first day shall be a Sabbath, and on the 8th day shall be a Sabbath. And you'll take you on the first day the boughs of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, and boughs of thick trees, and willows of the brook. And you rejoice before the Eternal your God 7 days. And keep it a statute in the 7th month." And in verse 42, "You shall dwell in booths 7 days. Now, they actually constructed booths out of the trees. They presumably would bring the branches with them, I would have thought, because there's also it's a case of wherever God chooses to place his name. And that was a one central location as far as Israel was concerned in days gone by. But it says, "You shall dwell." Now, the word "dwell," it does mean dwell, but it also means sit. It means to stay in a place. That's basically what it means. You can look it up sometime. You can find places where it's used and translated as sit, and you cannot translate it any other way. That has got to be the meaning. But you also dwell. You find places where it's translated as dwell, and it cannot be any other meaning as well. So it's being in a particular place. And the Jews, what they would do, they construct these temporary dwellings, and they would go and have their meals out in those temporary booths. Now, we have, Mr. Armstrong has applied the principle to the law, and we don't go ahead and gather branches and sit under the branches in the middle of Alaska. It's not really practical, nor in the middle of Wales, I will hasten to add. But you dwell in temporary dwellings, but the emphasis is on temporary dwellings there. But it is a convocation on the first day, a convocation on the last day, and a dwelling on for all 7 days in those temporary dwellings. Now, if we go back to Ezekiel, or go over to Ezekiel chapter 20, you find where God is angry with Israel, And there's a reason why he's angry with Israel, and how the Sabbath is the sign, but it's not just the Sabbath singular. It's the Sabbaths plural, which is the sign. And here, let's pick it up in verse 10 of Ezekiel 20, it says, "Therefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt, brought them to the wilderness. I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he should live in them," and actually do what it actually says. "Moreover, I gave them my Sabbaths," plural, I want you to notice, "to be a sign between me and them, that they may know that I am the Eternal that sanctifies them." So there's several points within that verse. First of all, it's Sabbaths plural, which includes the Feast of Tabernacles. Secondly, it is a sign between God and his people. That's the second point. But third, it is a sanctification. It is setting them apart. It's setting us apart. It's if you like, getting us and taking us out of the world, or putting us apart, separating us from the world. And what in fact happened in days gone by, what happened as the apostasy actually took root, is that that was changed to a holiday. That was changed into a direction which was against this, which was not separating them, which was not sanctifying them. It was not being, therefore, an adequate sign between him and God and his people. And you find in this particular chapter, notice in verse 13, and it says, "The house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if after a man do, he shall live in them. And my Sabbaths," plural, "they greatly polluted, that I said I would pour my fury out on them." And in verse 16, again, "Because they despised my judgments, walked not in my statutes, polluted my Sabbaths." This includes the day of the days of tabernacles. This includes those Sabbaths and the first day and the last great day. And over in verse 20, it says, "And hallow my Sabbaths," plural, "and they shall be a sign between me and you, that you may know I am the Eternal, your God." And it is a sanctification. It is a setting apart. And this is so vitally important, and vitally important that the place that we actually keep the feast, the way in which we keep the feast, it is a separation. It's not just a case of going to a nice place within the world and keeping the feast at a nice place within the world, so that we mix with the world and we have the gaming machines in the foyer of the location that we happen to be meeting in, and those gaming machines are turned on and kids are using them. That is not separating ourselves from the world. It's not doing that. And this is the kind of thing that was happening. It is not separating ourselves from the world if we look just like the world. We don't have to look weird. We don't have to look like the world's religions either. We don't have to look like the Mennonites, which is of this world. But we've got to be different. We've got to have the modesty that is there, and we've got to have the style that is there, the cleanliness that is there, as far as God is concerned. And if we turn over to Deuteronomy 16, this commanded assembly, Deuteronomy chapter 16, and remember, it's a case of planning for God's feast. It's a case of planning and picturing the millennium and our part within it. And that part within it is a part of teachers. So you and I, let's face it, 5 years from now, some are elderly listening to me. It could be within the year you will have to sit down and teach yourself those people that will be entrusted to your charge. In fact, that could happen to any of us. Any of us could die between now and the next year. It could be within a year. But those of us that survive, that manage to live right on into the millennium, it could be 5 years' time, you will have to organize a feast. You personally. Well, how are you going to do that? The entire earth is going to be devastated. And yet you've got to go ahead and organize a feast within the devastation. How are you going to do it? What are you going to do? What's important? What are you going to put as important in that process? This is why, and those that are listening to me who will not manage to attend are still going to have to do that. You're still going to have to do that. And here in Deuteronomy 16, notice in verse 13, It says, you shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after you've gathered in the corn and your wine. It's linked to the harvest time. And you'll rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter and your manservant, maidservant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow that are within your gates. Now notice the view that is there. It's an outward-looking view. It's not an inward-looking view. It's not the way of get. It's not the way of going on holiday and getting and grabbing as much as we possibly can for ourselves, while everybody else runs around and does whatever work so that we can bask in our second tithe and do whatever else we want to. That's not the principle. That's not the way. The outward look of the feast is that you and your son and your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow that are within your gates, all those that you are close to, that you can go ahead, and it says, 7 days shall you keep a solemn feast to the Eternal your God, in the place which the Eternal shall choose, because the Eternal your God will bless you in all your increase and all the works of your hand, and therefore you shall surely rejoice. And it's the case of rejoicing. And as I say, even those shut-ins that are not going to be able to make it this time, they still have a responsibility. It is still a picture of the millennium. And that commanded assembly, the reason why God commands us and gives us a commanded assembly is for us to learn that picture of the millennium, and the fact that we will be teaching it. And we will have to take these principles, and we do need to be back on track for that, and then apply them ourselves in the future as we administer the feast. I know one of the places that I suppose I learned a great deal regarding the feast was actually in Nigeria. And as we've talked about, and you know, Judy and I have talked about, is that every single year we went down to Nigeria, we'd lose weight. You know, it was not great restaurants and so on. It just wasn't like that. But we thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. We look back on it as some of the most meaningful and moving festivals that we've ever attended. And even without the electricity, even without the water, even, you know, you try and get a shower. In fact, you give up getting a shower. You basically have a sponge or a flannel and a washcloth, I think they call them in America, don't they? And you strip wash, and that's the only way you can wash. And that is provided you've saved a bucket of water from the day before, because there's no water coming through the taps. And yet you can keep a feast that way. And how are you going to go ahead and get your people that are going to be entrusted to your care to keep the kind of feast that Nehemiah kept, when they perhaps don't have water in the same degree that you can just go and turn on a tap and have fresh water come out of the tap? We've just assumed that is going to be the case. But when the world is going to be in utter chaos, the world is going to be devastated, are you going to wave your magic wand? Well, that's not what I read it in my Bible. That's not what I read in my Bible. So the principles are going to have to apply as to what is meaningful at the feast. Now, it is a case that God has got to place his name there. And one of the things that we do, and the way in which we learn where God has placed his name, is we pray about it, and even fast to make sure that we are close to God before we pray about it. We in the ministry, that is, that actually have to make a decision as to where we are going to go ahead and keep the feast in any particular year. But prayer is vital to choose the place, because you pray that if this is the place that God wants, open the doors and let us walk through them. If it's not the place that God wants, close the doors and make it abundantly clear that we don't go through them. And that's the way in which the place is chosen. And believe you me, the doors either open or they close. And you can either go to walk into a place, or nothing. No, all your energy and effort is there's no fruition. So that is the way in which it is done. And it always has been done, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I understand. But more than that, it's a place that God places his name, but that God is only going to keep his name there if we, when we go there, continue to pray. Or we continue to be in close contact with God, so the very Spirit of God is there. Have you ever been to the feast site, or one of these feast sites, before or after? It's dead. because people are not there. You go to the Ambassador College now. In fact, I went on Google Earth, went round to Pasadena just to have a look and just to see what it's looking like. And you've got billboards stuck on the auditorium advertising these are the happy clappy churches and parking spaces. And it just, you know, the whole place is changing. God saw fit to get rid of that place. It's not the buildings. It's not the beautiful architecture. That's not where it's at. It's the character of the people that is so vital. So it's a case that once we are there, we need to pray and continue to pray so that it remains where God places his name. So that there are God's people there, that we are part of God's people that are actually there. Turn over to Deuteronomy, just turn back a couple of pages to Deuteronomy 12, and you'll see how this was repeated over and over again. Just hit some of the high points. Now, I know that this is actually talking about the temple area or the place where the tabernacle was, Shiloh initially, and finally it was then Mount Zion. But it still applies, the principle basically applies here in Deuteronomy chapter 12. In verse 5, but unto the place which the Eternal your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even to his habitation shall you seek, and there shall you come. And that's the place that they were to keep it in days gone by. Verse 11, then there shall be a place which the Eternal your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there. There you will bring all that I command you, your burnt offerings and sacrifices and so on. Verse 14, but in the place which the Eternal shall choose in one of your tribes, there shall you offer your burnt offerings and do all that I command you. And verse 18, but you must eat them before the Eternal your God in the place which the Eternal your God shall choose. Talking about second tithe and the offerings that were made. You and your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, Levite, and so on, rejoice before the Eternal your God in all that you put your hands to. And final one, verse 26. Only your holy things which you have and your vows that you shall take and go to the place which the Eternal your God shall choose. So it is vital that we do find a place that God would choose. What's the kind of place that God chooses? Where he actually places his name. Well, let's look at certain passages. Let's look at Deuteronomy 23 over a couple of pages. Again, to Deuteronomy 23. And in verse 12 it says, you'll have a place also without the camp where you shall go forth abroad. It's talking about the latrines now within the actual camp of Israel. And you shall have a paddle on your weapon, and it shall be when you will ease yourself abroad that you'll dig therewith and turn back and cover that which comes from you. For the Eternal your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you. Therefore shall your camp be holy, that he sees no unclean thing in you and turn away from you. Now this is Deuteronomy 23, verse 12 to 14. When you look at the actual place that God chooses to place his name. Now, that was the camp of God. That was when the army of Israel was there, and the ark presumably would be there amongst them. And certainly the priest, it was a priest-led army. In fact, it wasn't even a priest-led army. It was the Urim and Thummim that actually commanded the army to do whatever it had to do. But that had to be cleaned up. And if there is a place that needs cleaning up, then time needs to be allowed for that cleanup process to take place. I can think of Butlins of yesteryear, quite frankly. That's what people used to do. They used to go down to the feast with Omo and Vim and scouring cloths to go ahead and clean the place up because it was filthy. But, you know, you don't go into the place and leave it filthy. And again, I'm thinking in Nigeria, you know, it's not necessary to have a place that is all sparkling, bright and new. It can be run down to some degree, but it requires therefore a day beforehand for people to go down there and clean the place up and get it up to scratch within your budget, within the framework in which you're operating. And that goes for feast sites anywhere and everywhere. And it goes for your feast site when you are teaching your people in the millennium. And you have to go ahead and organize a feast site. You get there a day before, You get other people there a day before, and you clean the place up. You do whatever is necessary to get the place cleaned up. Now, if we turn over to Numbers, Numbers chapter 2, you find that God, even though he was out in the wilderness, even though they were living in booths, certainly initially they would have had to have lived in booths. They came out of Egypt. They spoiled the Egyptians. What do? Did they all get tents from the Egyptians? I doubt it. How many Egyptians had tents? They didn't go on camping holidays, as far as I know, in Egypt. So where did they get the tents from? Well, they probably bought them from traders as they went through the wilderness for 40 years. But they were living in booths. Now, when I say wilderness, it's not just a desert area. It's a wilderness with trees, with shrubbery, with bushes and so on. And to a greater degree than you'll find there today, let's put it that way, much greater degree. But their camps had to be, they pitched their camps in a certain way. And here in Numbers chapter 2, notice in verse 3, it says, "And on the east side, towards the rising of the sun, shall be the stand of the camp of Judah." And it goes down a little bit. And then it says in verse 5, "Issachar." And in verse 7, Zebulun. So Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun were on the east side. And you carry on verse 10, "On the south side will be Reuben." And then go down in verse 12, Simeon. And down in verse 14, Gad. So Reuben, Simeon, and Gad were on the south side. And then you go down, and on the west side, verse 18, you've got Ephraim and Manasseh and Benjamin. And that's Manasseh in verse 20 and Benjamin in verse 22. Verse 25, on the north side, you've got Dan. And then down in verse 27, Asher. And in verse 29, Naphtali. So the 12 tribes were actually camping in certain areas around the tabernacle, but they were actually in a distance from the tabernacle. So the pitch, it says, far off about the tabernacle, verse 2. Why were they far off out of the side of the tabernacle? Well, the reason for that is that the Levites camped next to the tabernacle. But even there, in chapter 3, you'll find that the Levites also had particular pitches. In verse 23, it says, "In westward were the Gershonites." And then you're looking at the southward in verse 29, verse 30, the Kohathites. Kohathites. These are all tribes of Levi. And then in verse 35, northward were the Merari. And east in verse 38, Moses and Aaron. And so you've got all within the actual central compound, you've got these particular camps organized. The whole campground was organized by the tribes. It was organized within the actual area near the tabernacle, and it was all organized God's way and God's understanding. And what do we see? We see areas like SEP, Summer Educational Program. SEP was organized. It was people who went there 2 weeks before and set the camp up from a greenfield site. And it was literally a greenfield site over here in the UK. It wasn't so much in all Minnesota, but over here in the UK, you literally had a field. And it had to all be set up. It had to be set up from scratch. But it was set up and organized along the lines, looking at this as a basis, as a foundational basis. They would try to go and do things God's way. Try to look at things God's way. You don't have to have great palatial buildings to picture the millennium. But you do have to be organized. You do have to be clean. You do have to have it reflecting God's standards. They have all got to be there. The dig was another one. Totally different again. But again, it was organized. The kitchen duties as well. They used to have kitchen duties and certain office duties as well. Certain training in the afternoon. But you'd get up and you'd get out there. We out there at 6 o'clock in the morning, so 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock, I think the bus was, and then you'd work all the way through the morning before it got so hot by the midday. But it was a church camp. It was a church function. It had to be organized. It had to be done God's way. It had to reflect the mind of God. Totally different from SEP. Totally different from Ambassador College. But it wasn't totally different.
It was the same thing. And the feast sites also have got to reflect the same mind of God. Even if you're living, if you're down in Nigeria, or if you're in Kenya and you're meeting under a tree, those of you in Kenya that are listening to my words, if you're meeting under a tree in Kenya, you still do it in God's way. You try and apply these principles. You keep things clean. You keep things organized. And as I say, when you and I find ourselves in the millennium with a group of people having to keep the feast and organize the feast, we've got to do it God's way. And we've got to go back on track and have a look and see what is it? What's important? Is it a great holiday area that we've got to go to? Great, wonderful accommodation? Well, it's not. It's not. But it's God that's got to place his name there. You've got to cut the cloth, cut the suit according to the cloth. Whatever cloth you've got, you can't make a double-breasted suit when you've only got a limited amount of cloth. You can't make two pairs of trousers when you've got a limited amount of cloth. You cut the suit according to your cloth. And the understanding, I've had people write to me from other areas, other countries, saying that they'd like to, giving a location they'd like to attend. And I think, yeah, right, I would like to attend there, yes. But the costs involved, they couldn't pay for it. Well, I'm sorry, but although we give a certain amount of help and assistance at times, we don't go ahead and pay for something completely out of the ordinary, completely over the top. The place of safety. That's going to be the same kind of place. Can you think about that? And just think about the place of safety. How is it? What's it going to be like? Well, you can guarantee it's going to be done God's way. It's going to be God's camp. It's going to be reflecting God's mindset. Ambassador College. Again, you look at Ambassador College, and you look at Ambassador College as it was right on its peak at 1985, or whenever it was, when it's at its peak, and you think, well, that's the standard we need for the feast. Well, a load of baloney. Baloney. That's not the standard of Ambassador College when it first started. There were paint crews that had to go ahead. They'd get the major building work done by outside contractors, but then they would have minor building work done, plastering perhaps done, or something that could be done by the student body or by skilled contractors working for the work. And then the student body would do the painting. And they would therefore, the gardens and grounds, were the gardens and grounds always like they were? Ridiculous. Of course they weren't. The gardens and grounds were made that way by the student body. It was the student body that worked on the gardens and grounds and made them to the standard that they were. But it was the doing of it that was so important. We'll come on to that in a little while. And if we turn back to Luke chapter 2, a vital part of the entire process, and this is what we've lost, we've seemed to have lost sight of. We've got our mind so many cases, far too much on the physical, that we lose sight of the spiritual, quite frankly, the spiritual aspects, the camaraderie, the teamwork that is necessary, the pulling together, the potlucks. This is why I personally don't like catered meals. I think the potlucks are far better. Why? Because they teach more. That's why. They teach people to get on with each other. When are you going to have the time to do that, the opportunity to do that? When on earth are we going to have the opportunity to do that in the normal church setting? Today, when everybody's scattered across the world. It's only with the feast, when we get together, that we're able to do that. And that's what used to happen in the past. That's the way it used to be in the past, when the church was on track. But we've gone ahead and we slipped, and it started, that the rot started, not when Worldwide went ahead and said, oh, you can keep whatever day, choose the month that you want to keep the feast in. That's not when it started. It started when they started sliding away to this, me, myself, and I need catering for. Me, myself, and I want to have a holiday. Me, myself, and I want to go ahead and be down the beach most of the time. And that's the focus started shifting. It's all on me, myself, and I, instead of God and his feast and keeping his feast and rejoicing in his feast. But here in Luke chapter 2, Verse 40, the child grew, this is Jesus Christ now, grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom, and grace of God was upon him. Now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast. And when they had fulfilled the days, that's the days of unleavened bread, as they returned, the child Jesus waited behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother didn't know. Why? Because there was the camaraderie, because there was the teamwork, because there was family and friends, and everybody knew everybody else coming down from Nazareth. And they'd gone, supposing him to be with the company, went a day's journey, and they looked for him among their kinsfolk and acquaintances. But do you notice what kind of environment was Christ brought up in? Was it the kind of environment that we have in our Western world today? No way. No way. It was this camaraderie that was there. It was the family, it was the unity, it was the neighborliness. And that was accepted. It took them a day before they discovered that he was actually missing. He had that much freedom. And you know, one, when you have your people to look after at the feast, when you are the one who is organizing the feast in the future, in the millennium, you'll have to try and reproduce that kind of idea. And where do you start? Well, you start at the two trees. That's where you start. When they found him, they turned back. Found him not, they turned back to Jerusalem seeking him, and it came to pass, and they found him there. But that camaraderie was there at one time. It was there at the feast in Booth City, from all the accounts I've heard over in Texas. It was there in Paignton. It was there in the Butlins. I'm not suggesting we go back to Butlins. I'm not suggesting that for a moment. But wherever we are, we try and reproduce that camaraderie, reproduce that teamwork, reproduce that the way of God in that location, the Spirit of God at work, doing what was necessary. Now, the fact is that what the feast is there to teach us is temporary dwellings. Turn over to Genesis chapter 2. You see, temporary dwellings goes a bit beyond just a case of living in a tent, just living in a... In Genesis chapter 2, it goes a bit beyond just living in a rented accommodation or a caravan or something. But here in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, and the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became, that man made of the dust of the ground, became a living soul. So he had a temporary chemical existence. Chapter 3, verse 19 is also really hammers it home. In the sweat of your face you'll eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and into dust you will return. It is a purely physical, temporary, chemical existence. We are in temporary dwellings. And if you go over to Leviticus 23, part of the picture, this is why the temporary dwelling picture is so vital. Because it says here in Leviticus 23, verse 42, it says, you shall dwell in booths 7 days, temporary dwellings, tabernacles. Because it's the Feast of Tabernacles, it's a feast of temporary dwellings, of tents. You shall dwell in booths 7 days. All that are Israelite born shall dwell in booths. So they'll all dwell in these temporary dwellings. That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths, in these temporary dwellings, when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, I am the Eternal, your God. Now, what's the picture coming out of Egypt? It's coming out of sin. It's coming and leaving this world. It's being separated from this world, which we were talking about earlier on. And quite frankly, this physical, chemical existence, we start to realize that, no, we're not an immortal soul. When we come out of Egypt, we get baptized through the Red Sea, we start to understand and really appreciate that we do only have a physical, chemical existence. And in order to have eternal spirit life, we've got to be given that spirit life. And that's something... in addition. So when we're looking at a feast site, when we're looking at planning for God's feast, we're looking at this as a very central area. And if we turn over to Second Peter chapter 1, Second Peter chapter 1,
And in verse 14, it says, knowing, yes, let's pick it up. In verse 13, yes, I think it fitting, as long as I'm in this tabernacle, to stir you up by putting you in remembrance.
So Peter recognized that his body, his physical, chemical existence, this tabernacle that we exist for a brief period of time, is just that. It's like a tent. And it's the Feast of Tabernacles.
Knowing that shortly I must put off this my tabernacle, even as our Lord Jesus Christ has shown me.
And this is the picture.
It is a temporary dwelling as far as human existence is concerned as well. Another one over in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. It says in the end of chapter 4, it says, well, we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporary.
They're temporary dwellings.
But the things that are not seen are eternal. For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, this here's Paul also drawing the same analogy, were dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tabernacle is talking about, we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon, or further clothed, which is a house which is from heaven. We don't go to heaven, it's from heaven, it comes down from heaven. If so be that being clothed we shall not be found naked, for we that are in this tabernacle groan, being burdened, not that we should be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up in life. So that we have this picture. And when we see this picture of coming out of Egypt, then the camping at Big Sandy, the Booth City, was an excellent picture.
That is the kind of picture it needs to be. If we get something which is too grand, too grandiose, we lose that picture. It's no longer camping. It's no longer a tent. We start thinking, oh, well, this is permanent. Well, no, it's not permanent. It is the Feast of Tabernacles.
As I said about Ambassador College today, you look at Ambassador College today and you find an empty shell.
Why? Because God has shown us what is important, and what is important is not the physical. It is not the physical environment. Yes, we should reflect God's mind within a physical environment. Yes, it's right to have the jewel that Mr. Armstrong made Ambassador College the way it was. But then, once that jewel has been finished with, it's removed, and what is important is still held there, which is the truth, which is the way of God, the mind of God. You go to the millennium. How much of the millennium is going to actually remain? You work all the 1,000 years, all the way through, for the last great day, for the great white throne judgment. And then at the end of that, the whole earth is destroyed with fire. All the work, everything, physically, gone, completely, finished, it's served its purpose, it's over. So all the wonderful work that we will put into that will be gone? No, it won't. The wonderful work that we put in that will be spiritual, it will be in the minds of the people that we're training. It is the training that is important. It is the training that we have at the feast sites, these years, when we're back on track, when we're trying to get back on track. That training is what is important. That is what's vital. It's the same atmosphere, as I've said before, that we found in the SCP, that we found at the dig. It's a case of showing God's way works, recapturing true values. All these things can be said about it. And going on to point four now, it's a case of being part of being a disciple or a student of that way. And we're learning, as students of that way ourselves, we're learning then to teach in the future further students of that way. And they will then in themselves go through right the way to the end of the millennium, and they will themselves be teaching those that actually come up in the Great White Throne Judgment. And then we'll take it out from there and spread the kingdom of God throughout the entirety of creation. And it's always looking forward. But let's turn over to James, in James chapter 1. James chapter 1, it says in verse 22, it says, but you be doers of the word,
So we've been given the word. As Christ said, if you put in your notes, John 8:31, if you continue in my word, then you are my disciples indeed. If you continue in my word, that means you take that word and you actually make it live. You make it work. You're doing what it says. You're applying what it says. He says, but be you doers, verse 22 of James 1, be you doers of the word, and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. If all we do is sit down, we have this idea regarding the feast. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. We go there to learn. We go there to sit down and shut up and stand and sit before the ministry, and that's it. That's not it at all. That's not the picture that we had. That's not the picture that we were given. That's not the picture that we should have had when we were getting back on track. Because it's the doers of the word, not the hearers only, deceiving yourself. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man beholding his natural face in a glass, in a mirror. For he beholds himself and goes his way and straightway forgets what kind of person he was. But whoever looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues therein, not being a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, who is structuring his life around the principles that he finds within that word, structuring his life the way God wants it, this man shall be blessed in his deed. It's in the deed. Now the problem today, and one of the major problems that we've got today, is that we have a TV generation. We have a generation that sits in front of a goggle box and basically switches off, you know, switches on the goggle box and switches off the mind. And you then just allow your mind to be taken along on this whatever the programming happens to be. And if that's all there is, how much doing is there? We have a mentality which is simply just watching. We're becoming a bunch of watchers rather than a bunch of doers. But as I said, Ambassador College, people watch and they say, oh, look at these wonderful buildings. We want to try and reproduce that. Well, no, it wasn't a case of the wonderful buildings didn't suddenly appear out of nowhere. The wonderful grounds didn't just suddenly appear already made. The wonderful grounds had to be constructed. They were done by students. It was part of the Ambassador College education. Even people that had money had to work. They had to work. 20 hours, I think, was a minimum per week. 20 hours per week. And those of us that didn't have money, and I count myself within that, worked more if we possibly could, every hour that we could, in order to go ahead and pay the college fees off. But recapture true values. It wasn't done by sitting on a backsides in a service. It wasn't done by sitting on a backsides in a class. It was done by taking what we learned when we were sitting on our backsides in a class and applying it to the dances, to the games evenings, to the barbecues, to the sing-alongs that we had. These are the things that made the college. And to the work, when we get out there on our knees planting flowers or whatever, or the janitor crew, was in my particular case, there was a Dixon machine. It was your floor polisher. And you used to charge around the campus with a floor polisher, polishing floors. And that's what I used to do before I started working in the laundry, linked to the swimming pool. But, you know, we had to work. We had to work. And we were given I always remember a particular individual who was a medical doctor, fully qualified, and a specialist as well, working out on the grounds and bemoaning the fact that, you know, did I go through eight years of university in order to do this when it's pouring with rain, he's working out on the grounds. Well, he eventually had different work as well to do as the years went by. But it was the work, it was doing it, that actually was part of the education. It was part of what we were actually learning. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 6. Deuteronomy chapter 6. This is the way God teaches. This is the way you're going to have to teach. This is the way you're going to have to teach your people in the millennium. It's not going to all be done for them. It's not the way it works. Deuteronomy 6, verse 3. Hear therefore, O Israel, and observe to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may increase mightily, as the Eternal, your God of your fathers, has promised you in the land that flows with milk and honey.
So it wasn't just a case of listening, it was a case of doing, actively putting into practice.
Hear, O Israel, the Eternal, our God, is one, is the Eternal alone, is probably a better translation. And you shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart, your soul, and your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. So once they're in your heart, what then happens? And you will teach them diligently to your children. And you will talk of them when you sit in your house. And you'll teach them diligently to your children. And you will talk of them when you walk by the way. And you'll teach them diligently to your children. And you will talk of them when you lie down. And you'll teach them diligently to your children, and you'll talk of them when you rise up. That's the inference within that passage. Every single living moment, you're teaching your children, you're talking about your ways of God, you're putting into effect, you're doing. That's part of the way. Being a disciple, being a student, is not sitting on our backside the way the students of this world operate. That's not God's students at all. That's not discipleship. It is taking the word of God and making it live. It is taking what we're given and making it active. And therefore, if we look at the feast, and all the feast is it's a holiday, and we go there, and we're served, and we live in these wonderful locations, and we get the meals prepared for us all the time, and we go to a function that is put on by outside company or whatever, and this is the feast. No, it's not. We've got to take the word of God and we've got to live it. We've got to actually put it into effect, put it into practice. It's the only place that we've actually got opportunity to do there. You're somebody who organizes the potluck meals. The organizer, the ones that contribute towards those potluck meals, they get the most enjoyment and the most benefit from it. They're the ones that are getting the most from it. The dance. I can guarantee you the Bulls will be the ones that get the most out of the dance over in Kentucky. Because they're the ones that put most into it. You're given, it'll be given to you, pressed down, running over. That's what it says. And that's what it means. And it means that at the feast. What you put in, you get out. And if you don't put anything in, then you'll be miserable. You'll be miserable. The more you put in, the more, again, the organizer of the barbecue. It's being involved that is so vitally important. Turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. I was reading something the other day. I reckon Ecclesiastes was a bunch of lies. Somebody send me something by email. And so it's filled with errors. And it was in fact... The errors that it was supposed to be filled with were errors according to their analysis that disagreed with their particular brand of religion. That was the problem with it. Yes, it is written from a human point of view, but it's written from a human point of view to teach us lessons, to teach us vital and vitally important lessons. In Ecclesiastes 2, verse 4, I made me great works, I built me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made the gardens and orchards, I planted trees and all kinds of fruit. I made pools of water to water the wood that brings forth trees. I got servants and maidservants, and servants born in my house. I had great possessions of small and great cattle above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings of provinces. I got me men singers, women singers, and delights, and you know, CDs, audios, videos, and all the rest of it. If he was live today, that's what he'd be doing. All the latest gadgets, you know. You can think of all the various latest gadgets he would have. And musical instruments, and all that of all sorts, so that I was great and increased more than were all before me in Jerusalem. And my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my portion of all my labor. It was the doing of it that gave satisfaction. As I say,
What in fact happened in AC? AC Bricky Wood, AC Big Sandy, AC Pasadena. It was the doing of it. It was actually making it up to that jewel that it became. And then once God had got finished, you know, that had been done, the thing was got rid of. It's totally removed. The millennium will be exactly the same. Heart rejoiced in all my labour, and this is my portion of my labour, because when he looked back on all the works my heart had wrought, on the labour that I had laboured to do, and behold, all of it was vanity and vexation of spirit. There's nothing there. It's the doing of it that gives the satisfaction. It's the doing of it that teaches the lessons. It's a character that you build in doing it. That is still there, but you know, it says right at the end, let's hear the conclusion of the matter, at the end of Ecclesiastes. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole man. It's that the character that is built. You know, don't lose your place too much on the further back. But Ecclesiastes chapter 2, we notice verse 24. There is nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink, that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labour. This I saw, that it was from the hand of God. It is the doing of it that gives you the satisfaction. And this is the lesson of Ecclesiastes. That what you're left with, only thing you're actually left with, is the character that you've developed. It's something which is spiritual. It is an exceedingly spiritual book when you really understand it. But the pleasure, the accomplishment, is in the doing. It's actually doing the work which is important. Chapter 3, notice verse 22. And it says, therefore I perceive, well, let's pick it up a little bit earlier. All that go to one place, verse 20. All are of the dust, all return to dust again. Who knows the spirit of man that goes upwards and the spirit of beast that goes downward to the earth? Therefore I perceive that, humanly speaking, there is nothing better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion, for who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? You know, if Mr. Armstrong were to go back to Pasadena today and see what the state of the place is like, and the billboards advertising these outside churches stuck on the side of the house of God, you know, what would he think? But you see, that has accomplished its purpose. At the end of the feast, what are you going to have? Are you going to have done, suppose you go into an area in Africa, those of you listening to me in Africa, and you clean up the place, you clean up the area, you go out and you got some white paint and you whitewash the walls and you clean the place up, you tidy it, you get your brooms and sweep it all up and you tidy it all up. Is that done for the next people coming through? Well, they'll enjoy it, yes, they'll enjoy it, but it's done because that is the right way to do, right way to behave. It's the application of God's mind. And that application of God's mind builds God's character. And it's building God's character, which is all important. It's part of the doing these things is part of the character building process. It's recapturing the true values. It's showing that God's way works. It's all of these slogans that we had in the past. And we need to get back on track to, as far as the feast is concerned, this year and next year, and looking and planning for the years ahead. But over in chapter 5, verse 18, same thing. Behold, that which I've seen, it's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labour that he takes under his sun, all the days of his life which God's given him, for that is his portion. It's enjoying the good there and then. And certainly when you're looking at the feast, it's a temporary dwellings, it's tabernacles. These temporary dwellings, it's you'll close the condo or the cottage at the end of the feast, and then you move on, you go back to your life again. And that's part of the lesson, that's part of what it's teaching us, and it's part of what we need to remember when we're planning for God's feast, because we're planning not just for God's feast this year, when we're looking at sites for next year, if anybody's got an idea, they need to look at this factor. And also, as far as the plans for God, making sure it is God's feast, it's part of the purpose of the festival. Even, I mean, looking at this enjoyment of the work, God is a creator, and you look outside here, and I see the stream, and I can see the trees and the grass and the horses if they were there. But when you think of when you look at the actual record, the fossil record, assuming that fossil record, assuming our assessment of that fossil record is true, that assessment is that these things are billions of years old. Billions of years old. Has God taken that length of time to become, to develop what do we see now? It's no way saying evolve. It didn't evolve by blind chance. But if you've got a system, you try making a system. I mean, Mr. Fenderson here makes computer systems. You try making a computer system with this kind of complexity. I mean, how would you do it? And where would you start? But God's done it. And he's created our bodies fearfully and wonderfully made. All so that he can get to this place now and we can then learn spiritual lessons, character development, and be part of the character development that is necessary. And the millennium, as I say, is for the last great day. The entire process is all towards the last great day. And the place of safety. What's the place of safety? In speculative in many respects, but it looks as if it could well be that our basic goal in the place of safety will be to prepare for at least a portion of Israel coming through. Because they're going to have to come back to the wilderness somewhere. And where else except the place of safety? Now, again, it's speculative, but it certainly appears to be that way. But put in your notes Luke 6:38, give and it'll be given to you. What we put in, then we'll get the same amount out. And if we put nothing into the feast, if all we want to do is go down to some nice location, have a holiday, have the kids looked after, we'll get nothing out of it. It will give us nothing out of it at all. Turn over to Ezekiel 39. When we look at what we're going to have to be doing in the future regarding the people at the end of the tribulation and the beginning of the millennial rule, and Israel is therefore brought back into the land of Palestine. As I say, the chances are the place of safety will be for Israel, to gather Israel together, giving them a place to come and to have some kind of respite. And our work that we'll need to be doing at that time could well be to prepare the area. But what will Israel then be doing? What will you be having your people do? Well, it's not going to be waving a magic wand and say, making everything a wonderful place and this is all the facilities laid on and everything's working perfectly. Because here in Ezekiel 39, notice in verse 11, it shall come to pass in that day, verse 11 of Ezekiel 39, that I will give to Gog a place there of graves in Israel. It's 200 million. 200 million, it's a fraction that will escape. The valley of the passengers on the east of the sea, and it shall stop the noses of the passengers, and there shall they bury Gog and his multitude. These are the Russians that are being discussed by Mr. Armstrong on The World Tomorrow today. He's leading into this section on Russia in prophecy. But this is what is going to happen. Gog and Magog will actually punish Babylon, and then Gog and Magog themselves will be destroyed. And they'll bury Gog and his multitude, and they shall call the valley Hamon-Gog. And 7 months shall the house of Israel be burying of them, that they may cleanse the land. So the first thing they're going to have to do in the millennium is clean the place up. The first thing we do in many of the feast sites is clean the place up. It pictures the millennium. That's what we used to have to do. That was understood, because you're coming into a world location. Yes, and all the people of the land shall bury them, and it shall be for them in a place of renown, the day that I shall be glorified, said the Lord Eternal. And then there sever out men of continual employment, passing through the land to bury with the passengers those who remain upon the face of the earth to cleanse it. And the passengers that pass through the land, when he sees a man's bone, he will set up a sign by it, and then the buriers, until the buriers have buried it in the valley of Hamon-Gog. So they'll go on, and they'll carry on cleaning up the land for years and years and years to come. And that is the job that will be given to the people at that particular time. Let's say, it's not to go ahead and give us a holiday as such, although there's nothing wrong with having a break and giving us a break and allowing us to relax and quite frankly rejoice. We've got to rejoice. It is a time of rejoicing. There's nothing wrong with going out and having a snake and going out to a nice restaurant and doing things that, with the children that you wouldn't be able to do normally. It's not wrong having amusements of some description. But you know, it is wrong when we start having those amusements. I know one particular case, people living on the, near a beach in America who literally do not go to the beach in the summertime. They refuse to go to the beach. Why? Because of the outfits being worn at the beach, or the lack of outfits being worn at the beach at that time. And other times as well, they have homosexual gatherings again on the beach as well. They simply stop going. Now, we don't want the world. We don't want that kind of thing in the world. We do not. I don't want to sort of put us in a position where we've got the youngsters in a position of compromise. You know, having to go down to pools that the outside people are using. You know, and on it goes. It can go to the outside arcade games, the outside entertainments which are unsuitable. We've just got to be very, very careful that we choose the locations where God will place his name. We pray for God to show us where to actually place his name. And it's not this world's entertainment. It's not this world's way of entertainment. It's not the world's mindset. Now, if we turn back to Genesis 2, Genesis chapter 2, where we were before, what God's mindset is, if we're looking for a place for next year, obviously this year is where, in certain locations, I agree, in African locations, you probably haven't booked your place yet this year. I suggest you get onto it as soon as you can. But certainly in most Western locations, they were planning for 2014. But here in Genesis 2, and it says in verse 7, the eternal God formed man of the dust of the ground, so here's this temporary existence, and breathed in his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living creature. And the eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and it's there that he put the man that he'd formed. So the location that God has designed for human beings is a garden. It is a garden or a parkland. And that's what we need to be looking for. That's the kind of area that we need to be imagining. When you look at what, in fact, what happened as far as the contrast and Babel, you know, Babylon, the great, the mother of harlots and the filth of the earth, which we find in Revelation. What was that all in aid of? Well, you go back and you find in Nimrod began Babylon. And you find that Babel was where God confused the languages because Nimrod was bringing them all together in one central location. And Nimrod and Semiramis, if you like, and the Babylonish system that is behind that, is the foundation of our modern cities. And what's going to happen to our modern cities? Well, you know, put in your notes Ezekiel 6:6, the cities are going to be laid waste. They're going to be specifically targeted. They're going to be specifically destroyed. Cities are not the place that, you know, God tends to place his name. Now, I'm not saying that it's never the case. There will be cities in the future, certainly, but not the way they are today. In Ezekiel 6:6, it says, the cities are going to be laid waste. These Nimrod founded cities, these Babylonish founded cities. If we turn over to Isaiah 5, and yet I know that there are those within the church that feel at home and comfortable within our cities and feel very uncomfortable in the country areas. I'm not saying that we've got to be comfortable within the countryside, but that certainly is the place where God placed the man. He placed him in a garden, and that seems to be the place that is best suited for mankind and to produce the character which is the reasoning for existence, for human existence, in this tabernacle anyway. But here in Isaiah chapter 5 and in verse 5 it says, now
And now go to, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I'll take away the hedge thereof, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall thereof, and it shall be trodden down. I'll lay it waste, and I will not be pruned or digged, and it shall not come up, there shall come up briars and thorns, and I will command the clouds that they do not rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Eternal of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. So you see, the heretics of the church, if you put it into modern parlance, and Ephraim and Manasseh, is being referred to. His pleasant plan, and he looked for judgment, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry. And part of that problem, notice what it says, woe unto them that join house to house and lay field to field until there's no place that a man may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. And it goes in, in my ears, says the Eternal of hosts, of a truth, many houses shall be desolate, even great and fair without inhabitants. In other words, the cities are going to be laid waste. The town and country planning that we've got today, where did I hear the other day? I heard somewhere that somebody put in an application for some houses, a matter of a handful of houses on so many acres, and the planning came back and said, no, you're not to go ahead and put that number. Instead of being, I think it was something like 5 acres, and they wanted to put something like 20 houses on the 5 acres. And he says, you're not allowed to put that number there. You've got to increase the number to 350. So 350 on the 5 acres, and that, therefore, is their planning ideas. And he says, in my ears, says the Eternal of hosts, of a truth, many houses shall be desolate, great and fair, without inhabitants. Why? Because woe unto them that join house to house, lay field to field, that there's no place they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. That's why. Because our cities, our towns, our villages are corrupted. They've got a false view of life. They're not the way God intended. Now, if you turn over to Jeremiah, and Jeremiah 31, again, we're looking into the future, looking into the millennium, and we're going to be teaching these people in the millennium. And here in Jeremiah 31, in verse 10, it says, hear the word of the Eternal, you nations, and declare the isles afar off, and say that he that scatters Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd does his flock. And how is he going to do that? With you and me, that's how. That's what we're being trained for. And we will also be trained to implement the Feast of Tabernacles in the right way. For the Eternal has redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he. Therefore they are come and sing in the height of Zion, and shall flow together to the goodness of the Eternal. For wheat and wine and oil, for young, the flock and the herd, and their soul will be as a watered garden, and they shall not sorrow any more at all. Have you put in your notes Amos 9, verse 13 to 15, how the ploughman will overtake the reaper. There will be an abundance there, a total abundance. And then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance, young men and old together. And again, notice the community that is indicated here. When are they going to rejoice in the dance? The chances are at the feasts. They'll have dances probably through the year as well in their local areas, but the feasts will certainly be a place where the dances will be. For I will turn their mourning to joy and comfort them and make them rejoice from all their sorrow. But there, that is something that you'll be presiding over. You'll be doing. Okay, two scriptures now in closing. Deuteronomy 14. Because God gives us the means to make it an enjoyable occasion. We need to be planning for God's feast. We need to be planning for this coming feast. And we need to be have been saving our second tithe. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your seed that the field brings forth year by year. And you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place that he will choose to place his name there, the tithe of your corn, your wine, your oil, firstlings of your herds, the flocks, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. So it's where God places his name. And if the way is too long for you, you are not able to carry it, the place is too far from you, which the Eternal your God shall choose to set his name there when the Eternal your God has blessed you, then you'll turn it into money. Bind the money in your hand, and then go to the place which the eternal your God shall choose.
That's what we do for the feast.
And there you shall bestow that money for whatever your soul lusts after, for oxen, for beefsteak, or for lamb roasts, or for wine, or for strong drinks, or whiskies, or sherries, or whatever. Or for whatever your soul desires, and you shall eat there before the eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. It's a time of abundant rejoicing. Abundant rejoicing. And the Levite that is within your gates, you shall not forsake him, for he's no part nor inheritance with you. And so we see the use of second tithe and what it actually pictures. It pictures the abundance that is going to be there when the ploughman overtakes the reaper. It's a time of, you know, it is to be a really enjoyable time. But the time is designed as a time of fellowship. It doesn't need the great wonderful buildings. It doesn't need the great wonderful amusements all provided on tap by people outside. It doesn't need great catered meals. It needs a communal spirit. It needs the kind of spirit that we had at Booth City, the kind of spirit that we had in days gone by that was lost by worldwide on the road to apostasy, until eventually they therefore not only just choose to go ahead and go on their cruise ship or whatever they happen to be, but they choose to go ahead and choose what dates to go on now. Totally have lost the plot. We've got to try and get back on track. Because if we turn back to Revelation 20, just remind us as to why this is so important for us. But Revelation 20, it says in verse 4, "And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, and for the word of God, and had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, nor received the mark upon his forehead, or in their hands. And they lived and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now to live and reign with Christ for 1,000 years, we've got to be thinking along the same lines. We've got to have the mindset of Christ. And that includes keeping his Sabbaths, plural, keeping his holy days and keeping the feast, but keeping it his way, the way we were initially instructed, the way we initially had. But the rest of the dead lived not again until 1,000 years were finished. And that's the focal point of the millennium. That's what the millennium is leading up to. But this is the first resurrection. This first resurrection of those that are in the church now, that have learned and got back on track now. Blessed and holy is he that has part of the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power, but there'll be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him for 1,000 years. And remember, part of that reigning is saying, this is the way, walk in it. And part of that saying, this is the way, walk in it, when they turn right and when they turn left, is part of the plan for God's feast.